Let me say that I am about as traditional a scholar as you can possibly get. I got into this in a strange and accidental way when I was at Caltech in the late 80s, and then when IAF was founded in the early 90s. I remain a book scholar. I always will be. I don't really like computers very much, but they are actually useful for certain kinds of things that traditional humanists traditionally do and want to do. A little more background. Mostly, I spend my time either buried in the rooms that we have at the Alderman Library at University of Virginia, developing tools and developing the Nines environment, which I'll tell you about, or talking to audiences not like this. That is to say, talking to traditional humanities audiences about what's going on and how it impacts their lives. Because everything, it seems to me, that we're trying to do here, that everyone in this room is interested in, is running up against a very, very difficult barrier, which is the inherited way that traditional humanists think and go about doing what they do. When you say cyber infrastructure, when you say data mining, when you say functionality, when you say TEI, when you say any of these things, all you do is turn off the minds of the people you're talking to. This is like an emblem of what the problem is. And so that the behind everything is not the technical issues. It is really social and institutional issues that have got to be addressed, and the people in this room, who are people who actually stand in both of these worlds, have got to come to grips with, because the traditional people don't know how to do it. All they know is that there's something strange happening, and they are not there. It's like Mr. Jones. I'll give you a perfect example of it. A year and a half ago now, in the spring of 2003, the editor of Critical Inquiry called the board, the editorial board, together. The editorial board had never met since the founding of Critical Inquiry when I was at Chicago in the late 60s. So we all got together, about 28 people, 28 of the most distinguished humanities people in North America came to University of Chicago to talk about what Tom Mitchell said, the crisis in humanities. I came away from that meeting appalled, really, because of those 28 people, one person had heard of TEI. One person. There wasn't a single person there who knew what it was or why it was changing their lives and the center of everything that they do, the library, and, of course, all the archival situations. Since then, there's been a certain amount of discussion within that particular community, but it's still emblematic of the gap, which is enormous, and which really has to be addressed. So that when we talk about the kind of tools that we're going to talk about here, probably tools is the worst word in the world that you can use if you want to talk about these things with people who have been doing text mining and interpretation and interface design for years and years and years using books and paper objects. So that's like the first problem that we have, this dominating institutional social problem that has to be addressed. Secondly, we have, as we all know here, been involved with wonderful projects, content creation, horrible word, but that's what we call it these days. The great strides that we've had in the establishment of standards, infrastructure, for sure, the tremendous strides there. Text analysis and searching. We've come a long way. All those matters. Easier access, more interoperability of all kinds. But what we don't have is the integrity of an approach to this new media within the humanities as a whole. So Given that situation, a year or a little more than a year ago, I was fortunate to get an infusion of money, and I decided the only sensible way to use this money was to go after this institutional problem. And so the result of that was NINES, Networked Infrastructure for 19th Century Electronic Scholarship, a mouthful and also incredibly forbidding to traditional scholars. The NINES project is the overarching project for what we're doing at University of Virginia now, outside of IAF. IAF is continuing its work, but NINES is a separate activity. And the whole purpose of NINES is to develop mechanisms, institutional as well as technical, to permit peer-reviewed, online, integrated, and aggregated scholarly activity. Not just the accessing of these things, say, through Project Muse or things like that, but for to move so that scholars will go about doing their traditional work in born digital forms. This means developing certain kinds of fill-out forms and other kinds of interfaces that won't be forbidding to them. You hide all the stuff behind and let them do whatever they need to do with a series of fill-out forms and so forth that are not forbidding. The other thing that NINES has really three components, and I'm going to save the last of the components to the end of this talk. The first of the components is to put together a set of editorial boards of a very traditional kind, and the people in the boards are 19th century Americanists, 19th century Victorian scholars, and Romantic scholars. We've had to sort of hold it in check in this Anglo-American frame of reference, and a lot of my friends in Comp Lit and European studies are not especially happy with it, but I try to tell them that if we can only get this thing modeled and set up and running, then it'll be not that difficult to let it expand. So we now have the editorial board set. There are about 60 people, Canada and the United States and England, who are involved and have committed themselves to act as the peer-reviewing and vetting mechanism for the material that would be incorporated into NINES. The second aspect of NINES, which I'll be talking about in a minute, is the tool development aspect. I'll be pointing out the kinds of tools that we're working on at UVA, but many tools that I know that people are using and developing around here and elsewhere as well are extremely interesting to us and useful to any traditional scholar. But in any case, at UVA, we're involved in the development of through NINES, and the development arm of NINES. ARP, Apply Research in Patacriticism. I'll be showing you some of the tools that we're developing in ARP. I'll leave those for now. The tools began with a project that Johanna Drucker and I, about 4 years ago, began to dream up called Ivanhoe. I have to say that many of my best friends and greatest supporters at the time thought of it as kind of wacko and impossible. Ivanhoe is a collaborative online play space for the interpretation of cultural objects of any kind. Salem witch trials, Byron's Don Juan, it doesn't matter. We've been principally focused on the interpretation of textual objects, but it doesn't have to be that. They can be cultural discourse fields of different kinds. That was the initiating tool, if you will, or object that we had in view to try to build. We knew that we would need about $500,000 to build the thing, and we had no money at all. This was all done through another organization that Johanna and I set up at UVA called SpecLab, Speculative Computing Laboratory, which was an organization that was simply ideated. We would meet every week and talk and bring our own lunch. Nobody had any money, but we were able to sort of dream about these ideas. Then this money came from nowhere, and so we actually set about hiring a bunch of really dynamite programmers, all of whom, thanks to John Unsworth's advice to me at the time, he said, hire from the commercial sector. And it has been a tremendously successful approach to this, because people who do this kind of information technology work in a commercial frame of reference are incredibly goal-oriented. And so we can set timelines. You know, in the university, what we do, we love to talk. We have lots, you know, bazillions of ideas. And we love to sit around and talk about them and so forth. They're all very interesting. But what they're interested in doing is getting something done on a certain time scale that is given to them. And then they will meet it. And so within this all began last August or so. That is a year ago this August now. I can't believe that so much time has gone by. We have rolled out Ivanhoe 1.0. Besides Ivanhoe 1.0, we have in development Juxta, which is a text comparison and collation tool that is in an early stage. It's really in three parts. A rendering part. The first thing we had to build was the rendering part of this tool. How would you display text that you wanted to compare? That is in a relatively stable state at this particular point. The second part that we have to deal with is the authoring part, which is how you go about choosing the texts that you want to set into comparison and annotate in different kinds of ways and connect in different kinds of ways. And the third and the most difficult of all is the collation part of this tool. It's naturally connected to this basic object that anyone who's involved in textual studies needs to do all the time, which is to carry out collations on massive bodies of data. In the Rossetti Archive, for example, if you go there, if you have any sense of what it is, it's a very, very large body of textual and pictorial materials having to do with Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Blessed Damozel is a classic example of his work. There are about 37 pictorial objects called the Blessed Damozel, and there are 68 textual objects called the Blessed Damozel. In a tool like Juxta, what you want to be able to do is to call those things together and carry out different kinds of searches and analyses, and ultimately, within simply the textual materials, carry out collations on those 60-plus textual objects. So that's the second tool that we have in development. The third tool that we have in development is called Colex, which has a lot in common, as Jeffrey knows, with TAPOR and with the Scholars Workbox that is being developed out in California and other kinds of similar tools, functionalities, to go out and get different kinds of objects of any kind, gather them together, and then export them in different kinds of displays. If you think of, for example, a museum exhibit, that's really the basic metaphor and frame of reference in which Bethany Novisky, who is the inventor and chief developer of Colex, always resorts to when she talks about what Colex does. She sees it always in relation to her main interest, which is in pedagogy, you know, pulling various things together for class purposes and then putting them out there so that the students can work on them and then redevelop them, redesign them to their own desire and need. I should say that probably I should have started with Schema, which is an XML editing schema that we're trying to develop so that anything that comes into Nines will have, no matter what its state, the messiest sort of HTML. I mean, there are all sorts of HTML things out there that are really adorable in certain kinds of ways. They're just sort of structurally and logically not very helpful. So what we have developed is a basic metadata schema that will grab initially any kind of object that you want and aggregate it at a kind of Dublin Core level. With the understanding and the expectation that if Nines gets going, it will everything from its like point of departure from then on is going to have to be given into the Nines aggregated environment in a standardized way, so that the future development of these things will be much more robust and as I say, standardized. The last. In many ways, it's the most interesting to me at this point because we haven't done anything with it except talk about it. It's called the Patacritical Daemon, and it is an interpretation tool that is designed to track and formalize totally subject. All interpretation is totally subjective. I mean, that's just the way it is, What you really want to do, and the basic sort of technical and developmental problem is, how are you going to use these IT tools to formalize actions that are basically subjective and then develop different kinds of visualizations so that you can look at them and understand hopefully see how they work in ways that the surface rhetoric of any kind of interpretive action tends to forbid you to do. You have to get behind any interpretation will be an act of a rhetorical display. And insofar as it is an act of rhetorical display, it is committed to hiding much of what it is trying to do. So the point of this is to try to get at these hidden structures of formality that lie in any kind of an object. I want to leave time for discussion. So there's Nines, which is the overarching institutionally aimed part of what we're doing, and then there's ARP, which is the tool development part of what we're doing. Let me say something about the tools in a more methodological or theoretical frame of reference. Basically, our approach, our interest, comes out of gaming and play spaces of various kinds, as Jeffrey knows, out there all over the place. Our approach, however, is not it's skewed slightly at a diagonal from the traditional gaming. Works that you would see all the time, because our frame of reference is definitely centered in a classroom or in a closed research space that I, at any rate, have grown up with and is where I work all the time. So Ivanhoe is a game space or a play space, but it is a play space that really is only comfortably allows about a dozen people to play in it, as you'll see in a minute. The two kinds of tools that we are dealing with, it seems to me, as I reflect on it, are really of two sorts. And in our IT world, I think basically this distinction governs everything that we do. This comes out of Francesco Varela and Umberto Maturana's theorizing of systems theory that comes out of phenomenology, the allopoetic and autopoetic structures and systems. Most of the tools that we work with are powerfully allopoetic. That is to say, they are tools that we take in a fiction of enlightenment, and we throw them at certain objects that we want to investigate in certain kinds of ways. So it's like a hammer is a classic allopoetic instrument. You have it in order to make it do something for you, but you don't you have to really sort of do funny things if you want to use the hammer as a tool for reflection. I can think of amusing ways of doing that, but it's not an autopoetic instrument. Games, poems, any kind of aesthetic object is instantly an autopoetic system. We are interested in primarily autopoetic instruments and tools. That is to say, tools that are aimed at self-reflection, that turn back on themselves, that really don't, in a certain sense, do anything, but they allow you to think, or we hope, to think more clearly about what your thinking is about. 19th century philologists said that what philology was the knowledge of what is known. And it seems to me that's all that I really care about. That's what humanists basically deal with. It's not that allopoetic tools are not very important. They're hugely important in what we do, and many of the tools that we're building have powerfully allopoetic aspects to them. But fundamentally, the whole approach that we take and that we are interested in is an autopoetic approach. And so we're interested in reflection. All right. I talked about the tools development in Nines. I talked about the setting up of the editorial boards. The one thing that we still don't have, and that I'll talk about once I show a little bit of Ivanhoe, because we're so happy that we finally rolled out the 1.0 pre-release, the accessing and publishing. In order for this to work, you've got to have a publishing element to get the scholarly material out there. And there are, as you can imagine, all kinds of problems that are associated with that. Permissions problems, institutional problems, legal problems of every type and description. But let me go in here. What I have done is I've gone past the login ID. And actually, I've gone past it because when we roll this thing out to ourselves, we realize that the interface design at the login level is theoretically mistaken. It is in contradiction to every theoretical and methodological principle that underlies Ivanhoe. And so we've got to sort of change it. Its functionality, in a very narrow and allopoetic sense, will not change very much. But there's a secret sin involved in the login moment of this thing, and I don't want to show it. If you're interested, you can go look yourself and find out what the secret sin is. When you come in to, I shouldn't do this. If you log in to Ivanhoe to play it, this is what you would come in to see. This is a game that we have in play. Three Men in a Boat was the starting point of the game. Jerome K. Jerome's late 19th century comic story about these three men who are bored and decide they're going to go out on a trip on the Thames. Let me explain what the space is like. The space that I'm rolling around in here is the discourse field. Into that space, you introduce, each of these is a textual object that has been introduced into the discourse field by somebody, game initiator or player, as they come in. Actually, the game initiator began the game but with Three Men in a Boat, and that was the only text that was there. And everything else that has come in here has been added in the course of the game. Over here, these are the game players. And you'll see that they have different kind of colors. They've been color-coded by themselves. Down here is a timeline, which the ticks down there indicate moments when moves were made. So the little cursor type thing over here is we came in at the end of the game. Basically, that's what I want to say. If I'm looking at this, that changes. See, the circle changes because basically the circle, we were inspired to that, this design, by an online text display called TextArc. Some of you may have seen that a number of years ago. It came out as a really beautiful visual display of textual information. It's in a kind of swirling circle. It's not, as you can see, like this, but that was basically the inspiration to approach a discourse in this visual way. The visual way, what all this means, for example, is that every one of these players, all these are the same players that you see out here, are inside the text. The Dante Gabriel Rossetti called it adopting an inner standing point. And from his point of view, whenever you are in what we would call, or what I would call, an autopoetic system, you are inside that system. And so everything that you do changes the system. Every time you make a move, every time you make an interpretation, every time you add something, the entire system changes from your point of view. Which is why, see, I'm looking at it now from Nathan's point of view. And so that if I were to go into any one of these objects here, I would see it particularly from Nathan's point of view at this point in time. I go up here to Lacan, and if I went into this object, that object would be Lacan's object, not Nathan's object. And it would look very different because it will have been modified by Lacan in this particular case as opposed to by Nathan. So you are always held, the space as a whole holds you in the globality, as it were, or the socialness of the entire place, but every object in there is mutated from every other point of view. The interface design wants to, however, keep you aware that even though all the interpretations are highly subjective, they are all part of an interconnected space and system. These lines show different kinds of actions that have been made by players between each other. The game space is it asks of the player basically two different kinds of actions. One is to intervene in active ways in the discourse field by mutating or changing, taking away, adding to objects in the discourse field, annotating them in different kinds of ways, linking them together in different kinds of ways, pulling in new ones, whatever. So you're basically interacting with the field of discourse in which you are embedded. And the other activity that you're involved in is interactivity with other players and what they're doing. So there is action between moves that are made by the players, and there's action with the discourse field by the players within this entire sort of dynamic space. The overall purpose of the thing is to have a player become more aware of the complications and the interconnected relation between interpretation and any object of interpretation, so-called object of interpretation. The premise of this is that, in a certain sense, there are no objects of interpretation. There are only subjects for interpretation. And so there are the subjects who play at interpretation, and there are the subjects that get taken up by the players at interpretation who are themselves involved in the interpretation. I didn't talk about the tools over here. You click on that and you would add a document. This is a search tool. This is a discussion tool where, in the course of play, the different kind of players can talk to each other about what's going on, trash each other, flame each other, whatever. Chat tool is a traditional, as you know, game space tool, which really doesn't work yet, and we only put it in there in anticipation for a time when this would be much more publicly located. This is my favorite icon, the history log. We had a lot of discussion about, you know, what these icons look like, and we couldn't imagine what a history log would look like. And then I can't remember who said, "Well, why not just make a log?" And so that's what we have. This is a role journal. One of the requirements of the game is that I'll go in as Jerome McGann. I'll log in that way. However, as soon as I log in as myself, I am then required, before I can begin to play the game, to adopt a role, because you cannot play this game except in a role. So that's why you have these funny names around here. Lacan, Klapka, Nick went in. I don't know why he went in that way, but this was a sort of a test game, so it's not serious. Not that any of this is serious, I must say. But the point of going in under a role is to give you another level of self-awareness on what you're doing. One of the greatest sort of weaknesses, it seems to me, of all kinds of humanities activity, and it flies in the face of everything that humanists believe in and actually do, is they actually take what they are doing to be true. And you sort of fall in love with what you're doing. So you write an essay, and you finish writing the essay, you fix it up and so forth, and all you've done, actually, is to try to mask as much as possible all the uncertainties that are the most interesting things that you're writing about. And so you end up sort of constructing this thing that is like, there is the definitive statement on the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. And you know it's not true, of course. So the point is to write, as it were, an essay on the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner in a subjective frame of reference where you can watch yourself doing that so that the activity and the object that you end up producing can not be taken seriously and therefore can finally be taken seriously. This is why the game is a game and why fundamentally it's ludic, and why it seems to me to be, you know, really at the heart of everything that we do. I didn't go through everything. This is a customized color tool, and what that allows you to do is individual players can customize the colors in which they appear. I think I'll open that. There are two functionalities here. You can have your fill color inside there, and then you can have your stroke color, which is the outline of who you are. And this is an additional kind of visual cue to who you are. For example, in the last game that I was playing, I went in as a certain character, and I made a few moves, and then I decided I wanted to go in as my sort of antithesis. And so I went in as, my second name was Printer's Devil. And what I did was I took the colors and I reversed them. So that from the point of view of the other players, you would have a visual cue that I was there actually under two different roles. And the two different roles were sort of playing partly with each other and also with the other players. So it's a simple but kind of a useful little tool that, as you can see, is a help tool. There's the trash. That's where you post a move, and that's where you exit Ivanhoe. So let me show one other game here. This is a more recent game, and I brought it up this way. You see where the cursor is here? It's not the cursor, whatever the hell you call it, the little thing. And I brought it back to the beginning so that you can see what a beginning of this game of any game will look like. I click on that, and I bring up the initiating text, which is Byron's poem to his wife, Fare Thee Well. The game is going to be played, and I'm going to run the whole thing so you can watch. That's a picture of the gameplay. It's a relatively short game, but you saw a very quick run-through of the whole game. I'll bring this thing back to the beginning. First move. Girl poet has, it's perfectly obvious that she has done nothing to the initiating text. What she's done is she's introduced this, 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 and this. If I click on one of those things, the document will come up, and you can see a little bit of a bug. That we're having some problems with those things that always jump up in your face. Now, any of these texts then become objects for possible interpretive action by any of the other players. I am in the point of view of girl poet, and that is shown by the rhyme of girl poet out here, girl poet in here, and if I go into the log, there's girl poet. Well, we haven't met Mary Margaret yet, and we haven't met Printer's Devil yet. You can arrange the log by players, or you can arrange it by moves. So if you want to study and reflect upon what's going on, where these things have been going on, and you can also break it out. If I break it out, notice what happened. It's told me in the log that there is a commentary that has been added, and it has taken me or displayed this within the display space of the game. So you can look at it from different kinds of points of view. If I click on that, I can get the commentary that was added by Printer's Devil. You'll see that Printer's Devil, in this particular commentary, was appalled at a move that Girl Poet had made and wasn't going to let her get away with it, and so comments on it and begins to discuss certain problems of textual interpretation and, indeed, a sort of irresponsible approach to the whole question of accuracy and textuality that this particular person displayed in her really disgraceful move. So I can expect at some point that Girl Poet, whom I know, will not sit still for that. I'm now, notice, looking at it from Printer's Devil point of view. Now I'm looking at it from Mary Margaret's point of view, Girl Poet's point of view. I think in order to let some time here, I'm going to stop. I can tell you that doing this is unbelievably infectious. And you can lose days of your life while you get involved with these kinds of things. We have used it as a tool for research as well. One of the early and not very successful, but I can see that methodologically it can be and would be very, very successful if the actual tool had been working at that point. But we used it, we threw it at one of the most intractable textual editorial problems in all of English literature, William Blake's The Four Zoas. It is an impossible text to edit. On the other hand, because it's so impossible, what it is an infinitely interesting place to go about investigating the problems of editorial method. And so we had a very interesting engagement with it, not least of all by using it to expose the limitations of where we were at that point in trying to develop this particular tool. I'm going to stop because I want to say one more thing. That's what we're doing. I could show you some of the other tools. I don't really have time. The last thing I want to say is, for the last year, main preoccupation, although not my greatest pleasure really is in this sort of thing, but my main preoccupation has been trying to figure out a way to get nines to work. That is to say, to find a way that aggregated online peer-reviewed scholarship can be published. And so I've been traveling a good deal, talking to presses all over, in England and United States in any case, and talking to libraries, because in my opinion, there are really only two ways to go. One is through the inherited and traditional university press system, and the other is through the library. My own preference from the beginning, because of conversations that I've had with John for I don't know how many years now about the problems of working through university presses and the permissions and copyright and legal problems, especially dealing with materials like the Blake Archive, where reasons that I can explain, that university presses have an enormously difficult time trying to imagine how they can make this stuff accessible without charging the earth for it. From a scholar's point of view, what we want is accessibility to the work that we do, because after all, we are the people who create this so-called content, for research and pedagogical purposes. And we want it at either open access or we want it at a cost that people who are in our business, the education business, can afford. Those are the sine qua non of what we are after in trying to find a way of publishing. So we have a lot of problems with the presses. And we have had a lot of problems with libraries, although the libraries actually have a great interest in trying to imagine how they might go about doing what they already do. University of Michigan, University of Virginia, all kinds of libraries right now are enormous publishers. Someone told me about a month and a half ago that the largest online publisher in the world is the University of Virginia eTech Center. It certainly has a gigantic body of materials that it publishes, and most of that material is published. It's not really published, but it's made accessible for free. It's not organized in such a way that it is easily integrated for different kinds of purposes that scholars would have. Nonetheless, it's out there in these atomized forms. Our desire is to have, say, the University of Virginia or some consortium of libraries and publishers or whatever, put this stuff together, have people contributing to it ourselves, and have it organized and integrated for complete search, analysis, and interpretation. So that if you want John Donne's this, and you want Rossetti's that, and you want to pull them together because they have certain kinds of things in common, and you want to subject them to different kinds of interpretations, you can get at them. You can use them in class. You can use them for your research. And then you can put your research back up, and you can make that accessible. I've been talking with the library at University of Virginia for about 2 years about this, and they shake their head, yes, 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 of course, it makes all kinds of sense, but you know, it's all that kind of yes, yes, yes. Finally, beginning of August, the librarian, Dreamboat, set Martha Blodgett, who is the head of information technology at the library, as the head of a set of committees that we've been meeting every week since the beginning of August. And as of 2 weeks ago, they have actually, I mean, they're completely committed to this. They have thrown too many resources to back away from it at this point. And the their policy position has now been stated, which is to develop a tiered system of publication or distribution and open access that includes possibly licensed materials as well, and to make the materials free for use in classrooms and free for use in research. This is the policy commitment of the library. And the technical and developmental commitment is that by next spring, using the Rossetti Archive, using parts of VCDH, the Virginia History Center, and using parts of the Himalayan Project that is also at an IATH project, all these three are basically IATH projects, using them to model the technical and institutional problems, administrative problems, to develop aggregated online peer-reviewed scholarship and roll out that model with these materials in next spring. With the plan and the hope and the expectation that if it can get going, all these other institutions and individuals who really want this will actually begin to see a way of joining with it. Martha and Karen both see this as only really doable if it is if it's done in some sort of consortia arrangement. But you aren't going to get, if you go after this, it seems to me, trying to set up a consortium, you end up in the kind of situation that we have been in for the last 10 years, always sort of seeing that actual implemented event kind of off there again on the horizon. It seems to me that what you have to do is actually take a step. You have to do something. The library may fail at this. Nines may fail. In my opinion, it doesn't matter. Shelley says, we cannot let I dare not wait upon I would. There is no more time to do that. We have to get after it now. The crisis in publishing, as everybody in this room knows, is enormous, and it gets worse every day. So that's what we're doing, and I'm happy to talk more about it all. Thanks very much for listening.